This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Here in Griffith Park, you got to really listen up if you want to hear one of the most elusive animals to ever live here. Hear that? Sounds like a bird, right? Well, it's actually a mountain lion named P-22. This is the big cat who famously crossed LA's busy freeways to come and live in Griffith Park 10 years ago. Why did the mountain lion cross the road? To find a mate. But sadly, P-22 has been living alone there ever since. But why is he chirping?
It's mountain lion speak for hey, is there any other mountain lions around? And which means he hasn't given up even after all this time, which is actually kind of sad.
Beth Pratt works for the National Wildlife Federation. She leads the Save LA Cougars campaign, and she introduces herself as the Cougar Lady. She's actually got a tattoo of P-22 that takes up half her upper arm.
P-22 is the reason I got involved. The plight of not just P-22, but all these Santa Monica Mountains cats and what roads and development was doing to them in terms of fragmentation and how it really threatened, you know, their future.
The sad plight of P-22 has inspired thousands of people to donate tens of millions of dollars to help disconnected mountain lions find romance. The plan is to build a wildlife bridge over the 101, and it's now finally scheduled to break ground this spring. And not a moment too soon, because without intervention, new research shows all the mountain lions living in the Santa Monica Mountains will likely go extinct in the next 12 to 15 years. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
Imagine you're a young male mountain lion who was born somewhere that sounds like this. Other older males have already claimed all the territory here, so you're trying to leave. And to do that, you need to cross this. That's 10 lanes of the Ventura Freeway, where you might get hit by one of the thousands of cars that travels through here every day. But if you turn around, one of the other mountain lions might kill you for encroaching on their territory. Most of the cougars living in the Santa Monica Mountains have decided they've got a better shot at survival if they stay put. But when P-22 thought differently and made the leap, he earned his reputation as the lonely bachelor of the Hollywood Hills. He also inspired LA to think differently about their four-legged neighbors.
My connection to P-22 is very deep as it can get, I guess, I would say.
Miguel Ordeñana grew up in Los Feliz, near P-22's home. He's a wildlife biologist with the Natural History Museum who specializes in the camera traps that capture the wildlife in Griffith Park. He remembers the day that he found proof of a mountain lion there.
It was literally like finding some sort of urban legend, like a Bigfoot or Chupacabra kind of creature, because a lot of people talk about it. They are adamant that they see it or have proof of it. I was just going through my camera footage and I jumped out of my seat, literally.
There it was, proof, in the form of a big cat butt. But he says that cat butt, and later, a much more flattering National Geographic photo of P-22 prowling beneath the Hollywood sign, changed how people thought about L.A.
People thought L.A. is just a place for beautiful people, movie stars, traffic, smog, but it's also a place for nature, and nature that is not just like pigeons and rats. It's also mountain lions that are trying to survive and make their way even to the middle of the city.
So far, that survival has faced obstacles like freeway barriers, territory disputes, backyards filled with rat poison, and wildfire. Scientists say now,
genetic diversity were much lower than anywhere else across California or anywhere else across the West where people have studied mountain lion genetics.
Seth Riley works in the Santa Monica Mountains for the National Park Service, and he says signs of low genetic diversity start out weird but mostly harmless. Adult males breeding with their daughters, cougars being born with kinked tails. But then recently, UCLA researcher Audra Huffmeyer found more problematic kinked tails. This time in their sperm.
On average, like 93% of their sperm was abnormal. Of all the sperm I looked at, like 93% either had a kinked tail, a misshapen head, or like no midpiece.
And if you have a sperm tail that doesn't swim straight or another abnormality, good luck making new mountain lions. It's a warning sign this entire local mountain lion population could die out. In 20 years of observing these mountain lions, it's the first time that scientists have seen these problems. Beth Pratt, the self-described cougar lady, isn't surprised by the findings. She points out that the same problem showed up in the Florida panther population 30 years ago.
I remember when I was, you know, doing talks early on about the crossing, you know, back in 2014, 2015, saying, you know, the Park Service says this is the low bar we don't want to reach, you know, like the Florida panthers did, which was birth defects and sterility and all this stuff. And look, here we are, right? Exactly how it played out with the Florida panthers.
In Florida, they shipped in several female panthers from Texas to breed with the existing population. Now their once certain extinction has been turned around. It's an idea that's been tossed around for LA's mountain lion population, too. You only need about one new cougar's genes every 2 to 3 years to reverse the inbreeding problem. But Pratt says shipping in new cats is more of a last-ditch effort than a long-term solution.
And if we reach that low bar before the wildlife crossing's fixed, I'm sure that will be a Band-Aid we put on it. But what we stress is it's just a Band-Aid. If you don't fix the road problem, it doesn't matter.
Because the Santa Monica Mountains don't have space for more than 10 to 15 adults to survive there at the same time. So you'd have to keep dropping new cougars in to stop the inbreeding problem from coming back. That's why Pratt and other wildlife experts have come up with a more permanent solution. Expand the habitat and the cougar population by creating a safe path to connect separate small mountain lion populations that have been separated by freeways. For years, it was a hard sell. $88 million for a bridge that people don't use to save animals that people rarely see, except when they make headlines for getting into someone's house and eating their dog or being the primary suspect of a gruesome koala murder at the LA Zoo. Yeah, that really happened in 2016. Last year, though, all of the money needed to break ground came through, including a $20 million check from the state. And now Caltrans is expected to start construction in the spring.
We are designing this as connecting an entire ecological system. So, you know, butterflies will live on it, frogs will live on it, but also wildlife will get across it. In light of climate change and drought and fragmentation and genetic decline, how do we reconnect an entire ecosystem? And that's what this crossing is doing.
Their work won't end with this one bridge. The goal is to create a path from the Santa Monica Mountains into the Santa Susana Mountains north of the 118, eventually connecting all of LA County's wilderness areas with the much larger mountain lion population in the Los Padres National Forest. For now, advocates for the local mountain lion population, like Miguel Ordinana, are celebrating. The lifelong Angeleno sees P22 as a model for us all.
People come here for an acting career or getting their foot in the door in Hollywood. And he crossed through all of those intersections. He lives right beneath the Hollywood sign. And so his story is a story of survival. And in addition to that, it's a story of coexistence. And it's also reflective of how tolerant and appreciative the LA community is generally of wildlife and of nature. And I think that doesn't exist in other places.
And it brings with it new hope that maybe one day P22 will hear an answer to his lonely call. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's been quite the week over at UCLA, and it's only Tuesday. Yesterday, Monday, marked the return to in-person classes for several UC schools across the state. Some students celebrated the news, but others staged a walkout.
Hybrid!
No!
Hybrid!
No!
When I say hybrid, you say access! Hybrid!
Access!
Solidarity with us today. Let us go.
The members of the UCLA Disabled Students Union are demanding permanent hybrid access to education. Well, UCLA did decide to move in-person classes online today, but not because of the protesters. The university says it received threats of mass violence by a former lecturer, Matthew Harris. They now say that the threat has been averted. Harris has been found and arrested in Colorado, and the college will resume in-person classes again tomorrow. Here to talk about all of this is Breeze Velasquez, undergraduate student body president, and Jody Kreiman, the chair of the UCLA Academic Senate, which makes decisions on returning to the classroom. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Breeze, when and how were you and other students notified of this mass shooting threat? I mean, there have been some complaints about how it was communicated to the campus community, right?
Yes. It was frankly very disappointed in terms of communication and transparency with the student body, if I'll be honest. I was on strike, and we're still on strike on campus in Murphy Hall, but I didn't find out. Apparently, my roommate later texted me, and she let me know that she had started seeing this information circulating since 2 p.m. I was in a meeting with the vice chancellor and Jody. You know, Jody had no idea of it, I believe, as well. But when I did reach out to Vice Chancellor Beck during that meeting, when we were talking about all the other issues that we were demanding with hybrid access and other issues that student leaders were bringing up, Vice Chancellor Michael Beck informed me, oh, we already knew about this. This was an ongoing issue. We've been keeping tabs on him for a few months. Don't worry about it. Okay, that's interesting, because why wasn't the student body informed?
Jody, there's a lot to unpack there. Do you want to take a shot at responding to all of that?
Sure. I certainly agree with a lot of what Breeze said. On the other hand, we've heard complaints today that UCLA responded too quickly, that it became clear sometime after about 1 this morning that the threatening shooter was in Colorado and was under observation and was not an immediate threat to campus. And so people are complaining, gee, you know, you've put classes back on remote after 1 day for no reason. So a situation that had no good solution.
Breeze, you said you were on strike. This is the walkout, right? What does that mean? What does it mean when you're walking out?
Correct. So some students, there was about 50 to 70 of us yesterday who vowed to not go to class yesterday for any professors that were not agreeing to offer universal access, which is, you know, both remote and in-person opportunities.
Jody, what options do students have who are sick or immunocompromised? I mean, some of these demands, you know, they're talking about what Breeze is talking about, and the other students, you know, they live with someone who is immunocompromised, or they are themselves immunocompromised. Are there accommodations for virtual classes?
There are accommodations available. They're arranged through the Center for Accessible Education, and I understand that the process is a bit overloaded right now, well, more than a bit, and there have been concerns that it takes too long to arrange an accommodation. So the office is attempting to hire new people to do the accommodation assessments and work things out. We need a better word than accommodation, because accommodations are determined by federal law for accessibility. But for things like, I have small children who can't be immunized, or I live with someone who's immunocompromised, and those kinds of accommodations are not covered by federal law. And one of the things the students are concerned about is that kind of situation. We're working on developing procedures for providing that kind of, you know, accommodation with a little A. So, yes, there are procedures available for these kinds of things.
We've heard, Breeze, from professors and faculty members who say that trying to create a quality hybrid curriculum demands way more resources and assistance from other faculty. You know, the throwing on Zoom was a temporary option during the worst of the pandemic and shouldn't be the norm. So what would you say to that? I mean, are you demanding, you know, I hate to say this, but a subpar education? I mean, do you think you're going to get the same education on Zoom or online virtually than you would if you were in person in the classroom?
Yes. I mean, I believe we would. We've been doing this for over a year and a half. I will say this much. I did have a professor last quarter who offered both an in-person and a remote option should students be sick. And the only difference she really made was open up her Zoom and have us turn in, Zoom in, and respond to questions at the end of the class session to make sure that we were being attentive the entire class session. It was so helpful for myself. I caught the flu last quarter, to be able to have that option to Zoom in and not have to risk getting any of my peers sick because, you know, at this time, we don't really know what is the flu, what's COVID, and it was just really helpful to have that option. I will say that there are over 15,000 cases per day in LA County, and many students don't feel safe to be on campus. Many students are immunocompromised, parents who are immunocompromised, and they fear transmitting COVID to them. I myself have a disabled parent, and I know that I can't be going home right now to see her. You know, I probably won't go even home during spring break because of the fact that I could potentially take COVID home. And I really think that it's up to everyone's right to decide if they want to be in person or remote. It's not that difficult. It's literally only opening up the Zoom so that students can Zoom in if they need to. And students that wish to be in the classroom can be in the classroom.
Jody, is it as simple as that? Let's just go to, we can have Zoom, we can have people in the classroom, and we can Zoom at the same time. Is that a question of equipment and cameras and servers and things like that?
Would that it were that simple. It isn't just as simple as turning on a Zoom camera. Teaching to Zoom is really different than teaching in person. You have a different way of reading the room, just seeing that there are questions, having to monitor the computer screen and the chat and people who are raising their hands in the room. One group or the other is inevitably going to be shortchanged in terms of the amount of attention. And so Breeze talks about choice. Well, it's choice for people who have access to good technology. It's not a choice for other students who don't. So, it's always, like I said, it's just complicated. It's more complicated than, gee, just turn on your computer and stream your lecture.
Yeah, I mean, but wouldn't it be, I mean, if it's just that, I mean, if you don't have the technology, I mean, wouldn't you just go into the classroom then? That at least both options are there.
Faculty do have the option to stream their lectures if they think that it's appropriate.
Breeze, what's next for the students there? You're going to stay in Murphy Hall?
Yes, we are. This is a matter of accessibility. For a university that takes pride in being the number one public university in the nation, it is quite frankly a shame that its administration is using excuses instead of ensuring its safety of all students. I know administration will tell you that enforcing a dual modality option infringes upon their right of academic freedom, but a hybrid option does not violate that. So, until our needs are quite frankly met, students will continue to be on strike at Murphy Hall.
There's a difference between responding to an emergency situation and keeping the university open and curricular design. The Academic Senate is engaging in long-term planning, the beginning stages of thinking about the future of education. The issues the students raise are good ones, but the kinds of things that we have done to respond to an emergency are not good long-term fixes. They lead to classes that are not efficient, to learning loss, and to generally undermining the academic basis for curricular design.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on and sharing your perspectives. Jody Kreiman, chair of the UCLA Academic Senate, Breeze Velasquez, the undergraduate student body president, who have walked out of the classroom and are staging a protest at Murphy Hall. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. It is a new year, and despite the pandemic, a new slate of restaurant openings are happening throughout Greater Los Angeles, from delayed debuts to trucks setting up brick and mortars to foodie stars opening up something new. There is a lot to be excited about. Mona Holmes is a reporter at Eater LA, our regular here on GLA, and she's with us to discuss what is to come. Mona, welcome.
Hello, Steve.
There is a lot to look forward to, especially after years of hardships because of the pandemic, right? I mean, what's going on?
Yes, I've been mentioning here for quite a while now how hard it's been for restaurants since March 2020. And I mean, this is when we talk about anticipated restaurants every year at this time of year, usually it's a hard thing to do with, figuring out who's going to go on. You know, this is just something that my team does, but it's feeling a little bit sparse in 2022. Having said all of that, There are plenty of new spots that from seasoned owners, seasoned chefs, newcomers that are still pushing through. So that makes me feel very optimistic.
Some food trucks, Mona, have found a home. We're talking about like Ronnie's Kitchen. What's going on with Ronnie?
It's kind of it's hugely ambitious. I don't think there's a better story right now than Ronnie Munoz. He's the owner of Ronnie's Kitchen, and he's a seasoned chef. He quit his job at Kraft, which is operated by Top Chef Judge Tom Colicchio, to focus on his own business, which was spicy fried chicken sandwiches. And he started out as a pop-up out of his South LA home. And what Ronnie Munoz is doing is taking over a space in Hollywood that will house three restaurants. And so there'll be Besties Burgers, there'll be a taco spot called Todo Santos, and then an expansion of his pop-up called Ronnie's Kitchen and Bar. So it's ambitious, but I believe this 25-year-old chef can pull it off.
So there's some heavy hitters in food that will also debut in L.A., Mona. Tell us about Mes Amis and Soto.
Well, let's start with Mes Amis. I'm a huge fan of Chef Lincoln Carson, and the reason why is because he opened up his Arts District restaurant, Bon Temps, in 2019, which was really wonderful. He barely had enough time to get established because he closed in 2020 because of COVID. And so he's opening Mes Amis in February, cross fingers, and it's on Wilcox, slightly north of Sunset, and it's going to be in the Thompson Hotel. Absolutely go there, because this guy is well seasoned and knows what he's doing. And then there's Nsoto, and it's just for listener's sake, it's spelled N-S-O-T-O. And it's the creation of Nikki Nakayama and Carol Idea Nakayama. And the two founded Nanaka, which is N-N-A-K-A, in 2011. Yes, stay focused, folks. And they earned a regular audience, a Michelin star, an appearance on Netflix's Chef's Table. And pre-pandemic, it was hard to get a table at Nanaka. But here at Nsoto, when it opens this spring, they'll do that same level of high level of curation that they're really well known for, but at a more reasonable price, which is great for someone like me who doesn't have a huge budget to dine out at, but wants to taste really good food. I think everyone's going to be really excited to go there.
Well, and speaking of excitement, the Spanish chef, right? Jose Andres is making a big return to L.A.
Yes, he is. I mean, I love how international our foods are here. But he's everyone knows who he is. He's got quite the presence with his humanitarian efforts around the world. But his presence in Los Angeles, it disappeared in 2020 because he closed Bazaar Insomni because of COVID and a number of reasons. But this year, he is ambitiously returning to downtown, or going to downtown, at the Frank Gehry Project. And it's right across the street from Disney Hall. So it's a huge restaurant, entertainment center, retail. And he's going to have three restaurants there. There'll be a restaurant similar to his DC mainstay, Haleo, China Poblano, and his Vegas Steakhouse. So that's what you can expect. And, you know, I'm sure that it's going to be great because that's what he does.
That's what he does. Before we leave LA, there's a restaurant in Venice along the coast called Standing's Butchery. What are you going to find there, and when is that slated to open?
Listen, I love going to butchers. I love asking them 10 million questions on how to prepare something, where they got it from. Like, it's to me, it's an essential part of any community. And Standing's Butchery is a very popular spot on Melrose. And this year, they're coming to Venice. And what's so great is that they're going to have a daytime menu, breakfast. And I can only imagine that it's going to be great. They share a space with Salt's Cure. So that's going to be one that's really great for the West Side.
All right. So let's leave L.A. County and head south to the O.C. and one spot that is hotly anticipated in Garden Grove.
Mm-hmm. I don't have enough time to talk about how excited I am about the O.C. Smoke Queen, who has the best name for a business in the world. I mean, it's just perfect. And obviously, it is barbecue. But what I do recommend is that you either go to her Instagram or the Eater LA website to get all the goods on the owner, Winnie Lee Lacani, and keep track of when her Garden Grove barbecue joint is going to open, because she's doing something really special. And in a very male-dominated field like barbecue, it's really nice to see someone who is a woman dominating the space.
Mona Holmes, reporter at Eater LA, of course, a regular here on GLA. Mona, much love. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this evening. Tomorrow, LA came into the wet season and an intense drought. Then came the December rains, remember? Then came the January dry. An update on where we are rainfall-wise and what that means for LA's future water supply. That is tomorrow on GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, too. Get it wherever you get your podcasts or online at kcrw.com/greater LA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece today's show together. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and your ears tonight. Have yourself a great night.